Dave Logan will be leading the call today and walking you through the default future, both personally and for your organization, creating actually an amazing future instead. Dave?
Okay, well, Julian, thank you. So first of all, for everyone, if you're not able to see the slides, don't worry about it. It won't in any way diminish what you get out of the call, and we can make them available after. But what we're going to do in this call is first of all, talk about your default future. And as many of you as are interested, we'd like to get you talking with other people about the default future that you can identify in your own life. That's the first. And then the second thing is the default future in your work tribe. So that's your default future at work. Okay, that plays out differently than your personal default future. And then finally, we're really going to talk about how we move from a default future within a group of people all the way up to something extraordinary, which is stage 5. Okay, so those are going to be the 3 major parts of the call. And at several points, we're going to put you in some breakout rooms to talk about that. The rule on these calls is no one has to say anything, so we're going to put you in fairly small groups. And anyone who wants to say something can say it. We'll give a few of you the opportunity to talk about it in front of the entire group. So a little bit of background, and then we're going to jump in. The material for this call is, especially the default future, is from a book that many of you are familiar with called The 3 Laws of Performance, that I had the opportunity to write with Steve Zaffron, my co-author, and really want to give credit not just to Steve, but to our absolutely amazing editor, Warren Bennis. And without Warren, there would be no book. Without Warren, there wouldn't be this call. So I just want to say that Warren's fingerprints and love, for lack of a better word, are just all over this. And some of the material is also drawn from tribal leadership. And so this is really a synthesis of the two. Now, both books have something in common, which is a common way of viewing how human beings behave, and that it's based in language. Okay, and that's all we need to say about that. So we're going to start then with your personal default future. And so how this is going to work is I'm just going to kind of create a couple of little mental pictures for you, and then I'm going to get some people talking about it, and we're going to drop into some breakout groups to go deeper for those of you that want to. So now some of you know what the default future is as a concept. Some of you are very familiar with it in application. And some of you may not have heard of it before. So whatever your starting point is, this will go fine. Okay, promise. So I just want you to imagine, forget default future for a second. Just imagine that you are on vacation. Okay, you're on vacation on a beautiful Hawaiian island. Okay, and you're sitting in a chair. So you're on vacation. You're on the beach in Hawaii, and it is an absolutely perfect day. Okay, so it's a little warm, the sun beating down on your skin, it's just a little too hot, but there's a nice cool breeze coming off the ocean, which just cools everything down just perfectly. Okay, you've got your little drink in your hand, which probably has an umbrella in it, and depending on who you are, there's either alcohol in there or not. Both are fine, okay, for the little mental picture. And that you hear the gentle sound of the surf, and it's just a perfect day. And so then the question that I'd like to ask is kind of an odd one, and that is, what is likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along? You know, there's always the chance a freak squall could come up, or that a bird could fly over you and drop a little present on your head. But assuming that doesn't happen, you know, what's likely to happen? And most people would say probably more of the same. It's going to be continued perfection. Okay. So then, given that, then what do you do? I mean, what actions go along with that? And for most people, they, you know, kind of laugh. It's such a stupid question. Well, I would probably order another drink. I'll read more of my book. Maybe I'll get up and wander into the surf. But it's just going to be a really, really perfect, perfect day, right? And so my actions go along with that. Okay, now different example, okay? But it starts off the same. Perfect day, sun, beach, breeze. But something has happened in the last 2 or 3 minutes. And what's happened has been, if you've ever been to Hawaii and spent any time there, you know that they have these tsunami warnings that kind of wail up, and it just emits this screech, and a very particular screech. If you've ever been there during the warning system of this, it really gets your attention. And then it kind of spirals down, so it takes a little bit of a breather, and then it spirals back up, and it wails again, and then it spirals back down. And so you hear that go off. And you're not sure if it's testing or not. You don't think it's the time for testing, but you're not really sure. So it gets your attention, right? And then as you're sitting there, kind of trying to figure out whether anything is really going on, you see off in the distance a fire truck. And the fire truck is right along the beach, okay, right where the surf meets the sand. And it just comes up along that parallel line and pretty soon is right in front of you, and it's got its bullhorn pointed to the crowd on the beach, and the person with the microphone inside is saying, tsunami warning, this is not a drill, get to higher ground, get to higher ground. And it continues off in the distance and finally disappears from both what you can see and what you can hear. It kind of goes behind a bend, so it's gone. And in that same moment, the tsunami warning that you realize now was not a test is spiraling down. And so there's a moment when what is actually hitting your senses, your skin, what you're hearing, what you're seeing, is exactly the same as the first moment that I described. But here's the question. What's likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along? Now, having had this discussion with, I don't know, a few thousand people at least, here's the answer that people give. Well, I'd run. So you notice they jump immediately to the action. Well, wait a minute, let's not get to the action yet. What's likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along? Well, a wave, right, or mass panic on the beach, or something bad. But all I know is it's not safe to be here. So my default future, if I stay here, is, just to put it very bluntly, not good, right? So what do I then do? Well, I run. I run for higher ground. Maybe I help people along the way. Maybe there's someone who is a little hard of hearing, and so I help them. But the key is we're going to get to higher ground. Now, here's what I want you to draw, and hopefully you're already drawing the lesson from this. Number one is in every single moment, including this moment on the call for you, you personally and I personally have a default future, right? We have some way that we expect things to kind of play out. Now, the default future does not live just in your brain, okay? It also lives in your heart, and it lives in your gut. So I was working with some economists not too long ago, and I asked them the question, you know, what's likely to happen if in the economy if nothing unexpected comes along? And they went into forecasting mode, right? You know, they talked about housing starts and unemployment rates and the various indicators of economic growth or the potentiality of a double dip recession. And go to your gut. What do you expect? And finally, one of them blurted out, oh, it's going to suck until it doesn't. Okay, that's a default future. It lives in your gut, okay, as much as it lives in your brain. So if you go into forecasting mode, that's actually not a really good place to go. In fact, your default future is often kind of having a constant argument in your head with that little inner voice, okay, we talked about on the last call. So the default future is not given by the little inner voice. It's more a gut-level connection. It's what you know, but I got to put know in quotes here, what you know is going to happen, okay? It is what's going to happen, even though it hasn't happened yet, okay? And when I say no, of course, you don't actually know that it's going to happen. It's a guess, right? It's a prognostication. But really, you put some money down that's probably what's going to happen. So that's how a default future works. So notice the pieces of it. Number one, everybody's got one. It usually is unstated. Okay, often when people articulate the default future, it's done with a bit of surprise. You know, wow, I didn't know that was actually the default future. So it operates below the level of one's awareness. Okay, that's number one. Number two, that there are actions that go along with the default future, and they're automatic and they're unthinking. So I do a lot of work with people in the forecasting world and business, and you know they're famous for pulling out Excel spreadsheets and weighted averages to try to determine what action to take. If you're on the beach and that fire truck goes in front of you, you don't need to pull out a spreadsheet and make any decisions. You're just going to run. You don't need to think about it. As a matter of fact, there's pretty good evidence that the part of the brain that does good logical thinking is actually not operating too well at that point. It's really the kind of older parts of the brain, the reptilian parts of the brain that are really in control, okay? So you're just going to run. So number one is there's this default future. It operates below the level of awareness. Number two, it determines your actions. So it doesn't influence your actions. It doesn't, kind of bump against your actions every once in a while. It determines your actions. And it does it in a way that where most of us don't see the connection, okay? So it's the actual driver of performance, of behavior, and yet most of us don't ever see that it's operating, okay? And then the third little component of this is that, and this is where it gets a little tricky, but if you actually take those actions, the actions that you're now taking without even thinking about taking, those actions will take you to the default future. So a lot of people, when they hear this, they say, oh, the default future is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, yeah, but it's trickier than that. It's trickier because it's a prophecy that no one's actually ever uttered because it operates, again, below the level of awareness. Now, I want to give you a couple personal stories, and one of them is something from my life that I have never, ever talked about in public. A few of you may know the story, but most of you don't, and I hope you won't mind the personal disclosure. But I actually want to start with one from Warren Bennis. There was a point where, you know, he's the editor for Three Laws of Performance. He wrote the preface for the other book, Tribal Leadership. Very good friend and a mentor. And as Warren tells the story, he's now, by the way, hard at work on his memoirs, so this will be out, I believe, sometime next year. But there was a point where he was in the hospital recovering from heart attack, and he'd been very successful. He'd been president of a university, very well-known scholar, very well-known national leader. He had a television show, you know, by successful, no matter how you look at it. And as he was recovering from this heart attack, he realized something, that he didn't like his life. In fact, he didn't like anything about it. It was a perfect life for someone who wanted to be a kind of scholar leader with a little bit of, you know, national exposure, but it's just really not what he wanted to do. And so Warren said he called, you know, just mentally in that moment, a timeout. And Warren uses some language here that we have to be very careful about. There's no religious tone to this at all, okay? So please don't hear this in any way religious. And it's not anti-religion. That's just not what Warren means by it. But Warren says most people are born once. In fact, his estimate is it's 95% of the population. They're born once. They have a default future. They don't really think about it, right? They just kind of act it out. And there might come a point later in life where people look back and say, I really wish I would have turned left there instead of right. Really wish I would have, you know, thought about what I wanted to do in college or my first job. Really wish I would have thought about it before going into management maybe. But they don't really think a lot about it. And that's 95% of really the world's population. I mean, Warren was mostly talking about the United States here, but he'd extended out to the world. And then a few of us, so the number's obviously 5%, right, are what he calls twice-borners. And what he means by that is that these are people who look at their default future. They really see it. They see it for all that it is and all that it isn't. And they recognize it, right? They grasp it. They apprehend it. They see it. They don't run from it. They don't deny it. They don't hide from it. They simply look at it without any kind of reaction. And then they ask themselves a very simple question. Is this what I want? And in the case of Warren, it was, no, this is not what I want. And I want something different. And he did things that a lot of people thought he'd kind of lost his mind for doing. He walked away from administration. You know, he easily could have been a couple jobs later president of, you know, a place like Harvard University. But that's not what he wanted to do. He wanted to write books that were going to matter and write books that would make a difference. And, you know, that's what he wanted. And so Warren describes himself as someone who was a twice-borner, was born twice. But that second birth was one of his own making, okay? So what goes into it is seeing your default future, seeing the actions that go along with it, recognizing that there's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy here, that actually, even though you may or may not want your default future, yeah, that's what's going to happen if nothing unexpected comes along. And in all likelihood, it's something that you don't particularly want, at least compared to something else. Okay. So just one more story, and then we're going to drop you in some breakout groups and get a few of you to talk about this, those of you that want to. And we're also just going to start with one person in front of the whole group, okay, so you kind of see how it works. So I'd like to ask, again, just for a little bit of a opportunity to tell a personal story here. Again, is one that I've really never spoken about in public, but I got a lot of questions about it this last week while I was doing a program in Denver with some automotive executives, and just seemed like it was something that it's probably time comes out. So many of you have asked, you know, how did I come to do this, you know, to be involved in writing of these books and all this sort of thing? Well, here's the truth. I was on a very large stage, I mean a physical stage, and I was reading something to a group of about 1,000 people, and I don't remember the year. Might have been 94, somewhere around in there. And I was just reading something, which I, you know, had done most of my life without any problem. And all of a sudden, I became aware that something horrible was going on. And I didn't know what it was. My palms became sweaty. I got a lightheaded feeling of unreality. This was somehow disconnected. I remember thinking, is this a dream? And I didn't know what it was. And I felt that I was going to pass out. I felt that I might die. my heart began not just pounding, but pounding so hard and so fast, I actually thought the people sitting in the front row, probably 20 or so feet away, might not only hear it, but they might actually see the impressions that it was leaving on my, you know, the shirt through my chest. I mean, it was pounding that hard. And people in the audience described later that I turned absolutely white. And those of you that know me know that that's actually not that far from my natural state. But I turned whiter than I ever had before. So what happened? Well, it turned out later that it was after I got a good diagnosis, that it was a panic attack. You know, I had a panic attack. And these dogged me for about 3 or 4 months. I'd have them when I drive. I'd have them when I would teach a class. I was a professor at that point. And I just felt completely boxed in by it. I didn't know what it was. So I got into therapy and did the sorts of things that you do when you have panic attacks. And I felt it starting to turn into agoraphobia, which is the fear of leaving, you know, the house. Because if I leave the house, I might have one of these when I'm driving. I might have one of these in public, and I don't know what to do. And what really came out of the whole therapy process was the following. My default future was that everything I was going to do in my life was designed for one purpose, and that was to make my mother proud of me. And that had to do with the relationship that I was in. That had to do with where I lived. That had to do with my job. That had to do with where I went to school. It had to do with who my friends were and how I cut my hair and how I dressed. Everything in my life was set up for that. And the problem was, one of my mother's concerns at the time was that I really hadn't appeared as my own kind of person. So, you know, isn't it interesting? I was trying to accomplish something that I actually wasn't able to accomplish. And so, just like the Warren Bennis moment, I had to kind of call a time out and redefine myself, right? Come up with something other than the default future. But in every case, here are the steps. You see the default future for what it is and for what it's not. You recognize that your actions are perfectly taking you, you know, toward that destination. And number three, that unless you do something fairly radical, that is where you will end up, okay? So that's how the default future works. So first of all, let's just handle any burning comments or questions, and then I'd like to invite one person to just say, so the group gets another perspective on the individual default future, to perhaps say a little bit about theirs. So Julian, you can see the screen here. So let's start with any burning questions or just any questions or comments you got to ask or comments you got to make.
Oh, here's one. All right. How about Tim Matasio?
Dave, how are you?
Hey, Tim. I'm great. How are you?
It's good to hear from you, and thank you for sharing that story with us.
Oh, well, thank you for listening to it.
You know, I'm a Christian, and we've talked a little bit about that, and you shared how your mother was I believe you describe her as kind of a born-again, devout, almost zealous zealot. Is that right?
Uh-huh, that's true.
And your dad was an atheist or an agnostic?
My dad is an atheist, communist, skeptic, is now 86 years old, and can't quite get over the fact that I teach in a business school, but I love him anyway, and I know he loves me back.
Well, I just wondered, you know, what you see as the impact of those two, shall we say, you know, extremes on your life. I mean, you shared how your mother influenced your default future. Have you looked at what their impact as a couple and raising you and being in that kind of an environment, what impact that has?
Well, I appreciate the question, Tim, and let me answer it, but hopefully I'll answer it in a way that's useful, you know, for everybody. My default future and yours and everybody's on the call, the question is, what is it actually composed of, right? You know, it's composed of hopes and dreams and fears and even little bits of terror. And so in my case, it was composed of, you know, things like my mother's faith was a part of it, and my father's logical, rational mind. He was, in his day, a somewhat famous math professor before he joined aerospace, and there was a bit of that in there. One of the things that was in my default future was that I was probably going to go into some field involving debate, because around the kitchen table, that's what we did. You know, you can imagine with parents like that. Now, I should add, my parents have been married for almost 60 years, very happy marriage. There's a lot they don't talk about, as you can imagine, things like politics and religion. They just steer clear of those. But they found a way to have a very, very happy relationship. And my reason for dropping that, you know, little story in is there was a point in my mother's life when she realized her default future in terms of her marriage was that she probably wasn't going to have a great marriage, you know, given the person she was married to was so different, you know, that how that likely plays out and often plays out is, you know, not particularly well. And just like we're going to talk about going forward here, there's a point where you have to see your default future and the whole thing, and you either say yes to it or you say no, and it's no where you kind of pound your, you know, hand on the table and say, hell no, I want something different. And I distinctly remember I was maybe 7 or 8 years old when she had that discussion actually with someone, you know, in her church, and reinvented where that relationship was going. So anyway, I don't know if that answered your question, but it's the all of our default futures are a composite of our own hopes and fears, and there's little bits that we've inherited from other people, probably without realizing we did it. You know, we might be trying to win someone's love or respect. We're not even aware that we're trying to do it, right? And all of that just gets cobbled together. And again, it operates below the level of awareness. And so most of us think we're actually making choices. But what's really happening is we're acting out the default future. We're acting as though the default future is going to happen, and it's certain that it's going to happen, and so our actions tend to go along with it, ironically making it happen. So let's just see if there's one other burning question.
Yeah, hey, Dave, there is one more question from Perry. She was, person's own filters that impacts our own default future, or is it just our circumstances? So, Perry.
Hi. So there were two things. First of all, when we, our default future is not necessarily a function of our circumstances. It's
right.
Our filter for what we're experiencing, what we observe, everything in our life that have us invent our own, and it's not an intentional act. It's a default future, right? It's not something that we're creating consciously. Second of all, if you don't have to have a negative or, you know, bad perceived default future to want to impact it and actually create a new one.
Right.
So things could be going along okay, but what if you want the next thing, right? The big, like, what if you want to do something you've never imagined would be possible for you? Your default future, even though it's okay, could actually get in the way of accomplishing this other that you would like to accomplish in your life. That was it.
Okay, well, so two things that I heard in the question and the comment is one of them, it's not so much your circumstances, it's your filter, and those two kind of work together. I'm actually going to go deeper than that, okay? The default future, actually there was a moment of conscious choice, and many people, if they really start thinking about it, you know, can go back to a decision that they made, often when they were very young. I clearly remember just kind of looking at my parents and thinking, you know, I really want to make my mom proud, right? And then it sort of, like a lot of decisions we make, it just kind of slips into the background. We're not really aware of it. We can, you know, recall it if we try, but it's just kind of not there. But it becomes something deeper than a filter. It actually becomes something that drives not just what we do, but it drives who we are in a very, you know, dramatic sense. A lot of people, when they reinvent their default future, when they rewrite their future, people say who you are has fundamentally changed. You know, in my own case, after I went through that process, I ended up not keeping a lot of the friends that I had. And it wasn't that, you know, they were bad friends. It's just they weren't consistent with the people that would be in my life with the kind of, you know, noble cause that came out of that whole process. And so really it's a complete reinvention of the self. And that's what we're talking about, doing something really, you know, profound here. And after we do a little bit of work here on the default future, we're going to turn to how does this play out in, you know, in work tribes. And it's the same thing. When you rewrite the future of a company, of a firm, of a team, it's no longer the same company. It's a lot of the same people, but it's a different place, completely different.
They have a whole new context for what they're doing.
Yeah, well, in some cases, it's not even recognizable by people who saw it before. So did that address the comment and answer the question, Perry?
Absolutely. Thank you.
So before we go into groups here, I'd just like to invite, we'll just have time to do this for one person, but is there someone who's kind of willing to walk up in front of the spotlight and just answer a couple questions, which is, on the basis of this discussion and any other reading or, you know, work you've done. So what's your default future? And then what actions do you see kind of go along with it? And then the third question is going to be, is that what you want? And these are going to be the three questions that you'll have the opportunity to answer in the breakout groups here in just a moment.
Let's call on Mike Klein. Here you go, Mike.
So, Mike, what's your default future?
What shows up is something along the lines of being ineffective, frustrated, and broke.
Wow. So frustrated, ineffective, and broke.
Yeah.
The great thing about that, Mike, is that forms an acronym, which is FIB. So it's very memorable. So then, Mike, what actions, if that's your default future and it's living in your gut and every once in a while it creeps up into your brain, what actions do you find yourself taking without even thinking about them?
Well, I just came off of 6 months of trying to generate consulting business for myself.
Uh-huh.
And doing a lot of blogging and writing and getting some traction, but like not major traction. Like, you know, getting a couple of hundred people interested in what I was doing rather than getting thousands and getting like one piece of consulting business that hasn't even really generated any money. And then finally just taking, you know, a very nice in-house role, but, you know, one that was kind of comparable to what I was doing before I went into consulting.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's a certain amount of flailing and frustration and, you know, I'm sick of this, so I'm gonna take a break from it for a while.
Right. So it was, you know, it's such a great case, you know, Mike, because obviously if you're flailing and you're frustrated and acting out that sense of frustration and then at some point you take a break from it, there's a pretty good chance you're going to end up frustrated and broke, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the – now, as people are going through this, you know, you might say, and I suspect about 30% of the people on the call are thinking, actually, you know, my default future is not so bad, right? Now, Mike, in the case of yours, you probably want to do something about that. But for people whose default future, you know, is what they want, you might get to that third question, which is this, you know, is this what you want, and say, sure, that's what I want. Well, then you're making a very informed choice to keep going in the direction you're going, and if it's working for you, then great. But at least you've kind of done a check-in, and then you can proceed with the certainty that that is where you want to go. But, Mike, so we round out the questions here, is that what you want? You want to end frustrated and broke?
No. No, I mean, I want to be you, but that's beside the point.
You're funny, Mike. Okay, well, so we see how it works, right? Now, just one little, so Michael, or Mike, sorry, thank you for dropping that in the mix here. Just for everyone, a little technicality, okay, then we're going to go into the groups. When you get to the default future, if you like 90% of it, but 10% of it's, you know, you'd like to get out the paint and maybe do a little touch-up, you actually don't get to do that, okay? The default future is a package. It's kind of like a car that you're looking at, and maybe this car has everything that you want. It's the right color, it's the right sound system, you love the seats, but you know, it's just an inch too short, just an inch too small. Well, you're probably going to want to look at a different car, right? If it's got everything but it's just a little bit too small, you probably need to look at another car. Or, you know, it's perfect except if only its seats were, you know, a little bit more this or a little bit more that, you really need to take a look at another car. So when we get to the what do you do about it part, you really need to start over. Now, when you start over, you can copy a lot of what you already have, but you need to start with that blank slate and need to really start over, okay? So what we'll do now is just go into groups. We're only going to take 5 minutes for this, okay? We're going to drop people into groups of three. So when you find yourself in a group of three, here are the questions to ask and answer. And if everyone who wants to should answer the three questions. So here's what they are. My default future is, just complete that sentence. And then the actions that I find myself taking without even thinking about it are, okay, that's the second question. And then the third question is that what you want? And you get to say yes or you get to say no. Okay, those are the three questions. So, Julian, let's drop them in groups, and we'll give them 5 minutes, and we'll reconvene here in the big room in exactly 5 minutes from now. So we're back in the big room here. So we're going to go on to the next part of it now, which is how all this plays out in work tribes and organizationally, which is really different than how it plays out in our personal lives. So, Julian, let's move to the second slide. Okay, so for those of you on the web, what's about to appear is really just a summary of what we've talked about. So the default future answers the question, what's likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along? Every group, family, division, organization, company, and person has a default future. And the default future lives at the gut level. It's rarely discussed, and so is invisible. Okay. So we've now moved to the third slide, and this is the last one that we have. So again, if you're not seeing the slides, you know, don't worry about it. We'll So as we look at this slide, what we see here is that with a default future for a group, it plays out in very specific ways. Now let me start with just an example of this, and one of the more moving examples. If you think back to the founding of the United States, you know, back in the days when there were 13 colonies under Britain, right? So what was the default future? You know, just think about this if you know any history. What was the default future of the colonies under Great Britain? And the answer was taxation without representation, and it was an economic depression, kind of before economics was the field in the way that it is now, but really an economic depression having to do with how the colonies were being treated, and they would send various delegates from the colonies to meet with the king and the different officials, and they'd generally be turned away. You know, they're just the local little colony representatives. I mean, why should I, as the king, meet with those people, right? So turn them away. So that was the default future. It was depression, and I mean that economically, as well as kind of, you know, the collective sense of everybody. And so then what actions go along with that? Well, you know, we kind of mope around, and we have little skirmishes between the colonies, and the colonies never really come together and speak with a single voice, and that was part of what England was trying to do at the time. And we're just going to kind of, you know, hobble along, and, you know, we'll get bigger, I guess, and probably poorer, and then eventually, I don't know, maybe the king will die, and there'll be a new king, and maybe the next one will be better, but probably not. That was the default future. And so a group of people got together and really thought about that, and they saw it for what it was, every piece of it. They didn't deny it. They didn't exaggerate it. They simply saw it for what it was, and they said, is that what we want? And they said, no. They said, in fact, hell no, that we are going to do something different. Now, it's easy for us looking back to see that as a moment of, you know, glory, and you know, the Hollywood spotlights were hitting people, and the fan off in the background was making people's hair ripple in that kind of heroic way as people stood up. No, here was the truth. They were scared. Many of them were poor. Many of them thought that their lives would end badly if they actually, you know, stood up and said that. It was a moment of, you know, it was a moment of heroism. It was also a moment of stark terror, right? Because you don't know what's on the other side. If you say no to the default future, there is nothing there. It's a blank slate. You get to redraw it. But the world isn't particularly happy with your blank slate. They want it to go back the way it was. So this group of people got together and said, hell no. You know, and they pounded the desk. And, okay, well then, if we don't want that, what do we want instead? Well, we want freedom, and we want independence, and we want to form our own government, and we want the first modern democratic state. And they went on and on about what they wanted. Okay, well then what's the first step? What is a bold action that's consistent not with the default future, but with what they were starting to come up with? So in CultureSync, we talk about what replaces the default future as being a noble cause, right? And the noble cause for the colonies that turned into the United States was the first experiment in democracy for the world, to show the world whether democracy could actually work in the modern world. And that was the noble cause. And then based on that, well, what's a bold action? Well, we got to get together and we got to, you know, write a document. Now, if you were like me and you were in school and you read the Declaration of Independence, you kind of skip over about 60 or 70% of it because it's King George this and King George that. It's very negative, you know, toward King George. In fact, some people have called it an indictment of King George. We remember the parts of it about inalienable rights and things that seem very grand. But, well, why did people do that? Because the Declaration of Independence was an articulation of the default future. And then it was giving the reason for saying no to it, and it was saying what they wanted instead, which had to do with the absolute rights of the individual, including freedom and independence and the right to self-determination. So that was an example of a tribe coming together, seeing their default future, and saying, hell no. And on that basis, really creating something really different. Okay, so what's on the slide then is there are only five ways that a tribe, a group of people, can interact with the default future, okay, or with what replaces it, again, which is a noble cause. So what we call stage one, those of you that have read Tribal Leadership, you know this, but this hopefully is a little bit of new material. The group says, life sucks, right? Life is despairing. It is unfair. You can't cut a break. Okay, but remember, this is a whole group of people. We're not just talking about an individual. So then what is their future? Well, it's the default future, but this particular default future is inevitable, and it is utterly bleak. Okay, so I want you to imagine a tribe somewhere in the world that has this default future. It's utterly bleak. There's nothing we can do about it. Life is inherently unfair. If you've been on other calls, you know what the generalized terministic screen is, the way that people see the world composed through language. Life is inherently unfair. Well, one of the things that people will do coming out of this sort of an environment is they'll attach explosives to their bodies, and they'll go to a crowded marketplace, and they'll detonate them, right? Because that's the only way that I can be known as an individual. That's the only thing that I can do to, in some small way, fight back. Right? That's the cause of terrorism. That's the cause of gangs. That's the cause of criminality all around the world is stage one, where the default future is utterly bleak, devoid of hope, and it's inevitable. Okay? So stage two. Now remember, this is my life sucks. This is, you know, groups that are just kind of hanging out, not getting a lot done. We like to joke about the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Transportation Security Administration when we go through and, you know, how come the line takes so long and how come they don't just open another line when you've got 15 people standing around not doing anything. It's kind of stage two. What we look at it as being just kind of inept, right? Well, what's the future? Well, it's the default future, but it's not inevitable and it's not utterly bleak. It's just a bummer, right? The default future is a bummer. You know, I'll be in this job for the next 10 years. You know, sure, I'll eat. And I'll have enough money to pay my rent, barely. But every day is going to be a grind. Maybe I'll go home and watch Springer on TiVo when I get home. And that's my one little, you know, part of the day that's good. But it's just kind of a bummer. That's the default future of the group. Now, it's not inevitable, but it's pretty darn certain, right? So the probability level falls a little bit from stage one. But it's kind of a bummer. So what happens if people's default future, remember this is a group, is a bummer? Well, they do the minimum to not get fired. Right? They just kind of, you know, plod along through life. And if you just go to different parts of the world and take a look, a big part of the world's population lives in stage two. They have stage two tribes, right? I mean, it's a bummer right now. That's the default future. The economy's down. There aren't a lot of good jobs. Just kind of hang out and wait. Maybe it'll get better. It'll suck until it won't. That's kind of stage two, right? So now let's then talk about what you can do about it from the perspective of the default future. The problem with stage two is that people don't want the default future, but there's not enough oomph, there's not enough fire and passion to overcome it. Okay? So what you do as a member of a stage two group is you find the people that are passionate, that don't want it, and really want to do something about it. Those are probably the individuals in the group that are more sparking a bit towards stage three. Okay? So they're individually motivated. They're people who want their lives to matter. They don't want the group to go in the way that it's going, but individuals cannot overcome the group default future. It's just too big. The group wins. The group is dominant. Okay. So you find those individuals. Now, let's go back to stage one for a minute. You know, what can you really do there? Well, there you want to get people to change tribes. I mean, literally, you want to get people to move to a different tribe, move to a different part of the world perhaps, or find a different group of people to hang out in. Because the default future in stage one is absolutely inevitable. And if you say, let's do something about it, it's not that people will laugh with the sarcasm of stage two. They just say that's impossible, right? Can't do it. It can't be rewritten. It's too big. History is moving against us. It's just the way life is set up. Okay. So at stage two, you want to find the people who really don't want it to be that way. And this is sort of the story of the American independence. It was mostly kind of stage one, stage two, but a few folks, mostly at stage three, got together and they cobbled together something that really spoke for the group and moved that group up to stage four. Okay, so then how does the default future play out in stage three? So if you're new to tribal leadership, stage three is this zone of I'm great and you're not, right? And imagine that this is a whole group of people talking this way, not an individual, but a whole group. Okay, we see this in sales, and we see it in medicine, and we see it in law. and we see it in academia and in management consulting and in places, you know, where people write books. This is kind of how it is. I'm great and you're not. You know, how much did you sell last month? Oh, I sold way more than that. Well, I didn't sell as much, but I was planning new leads, so you just wait until next month. So at stage three, here's what happens. If you point out to people what the default future is and the actions that go along with it, individuals will rise to the occasion. Individuals will. And here's what they'll say. Well, if only everybody would just shut up and listen to me and do what I'm saying, we could overcome this default future, but no one's listening to me. And so I'm just going to cross my arms and kind of opt out, but I'll wait until they finally wise up to the fact, you know, that I got the key here, that I've got the solution. And so we call stage three, in terms of the futures, it's the war of the futures, right? You get a whole bunch of individuals all wanting to reject the default future, all saying hell no, but they can't come up with anything as a group that speaks for the entire set of people. And we think this is where the tribal leadership material is really powerful, okay? In terms of triadic relationships that John King talks so much about, in terms of finding those shared core values below which, you know, there's nothing. Those are the core values that define people, and that sense of a noble cause that makes individual heads turn. You know, we often talk about the Manhattan Project. Every person in the room, this is the group that built the first atomic bomb under Robert Oppenheimer, every person in the room had always been the smartest person in the room. I mean, how do you get a stage four group to form when you get the inventor of quantum mechanics as one of the members of it? I mean, how do you do that? Well, what Oppenheimer did so artfully was he created a common noble cause, which had to do with the United States getting that before the Nazis got it, and many of the people in the room being German Jews who had left Germany as Nazism was on the ascent. They saw what that was going to mean. They saw the default future, that if the Nazis got that first, it would be cataclysmic for the world. So that brought the group up to stage four. Okay. So again, this has to do a lot with what we talk about in Culture Sync and tribal leadership, about identification of a noble cause and forming triadic relationships based on values, finding those values that allow us, like, and you've heard this before from me if you've been on other calls, like Martin Luther, the founder of the Lutheran Church, to say, you know, here I stand, or here we stand, we can do no other. That really moves it up to stage four. So at stage four, it's really an invented future. You know, it's a noble cause, and it's fueled by these tribal values. Okay, so you have to find out what values, what core values really are at work in individual hearts and souls and guts in the group, and you're the person who articulates all of those. And this is what George Washington did when the country was new. You know, he said, I hear you all saying freedom and independence, and that turned people's heads. People said, yes, he speaks for me, right? And then how do you move from stage four to stage five? Well, the future that's going on at stage five is so malleable. It's so changeable, right? It's changing by the moment. Every time someone comes up and, you know, utters something, or you find a new group to partner with based not on just shared values, but based on resonant values with people, that future is changing and morphing, and it's becoming something grander by the minute. People have actually developed the capacity to reinvent themselves individually and tribally on the fly, and those are the groups that go on, you know, to really, really change the world. So I want to give you some practices here in a minute that can help with this, and take any questions and comments that you have. But I just want to wrap all this up with a single story, and that was the story of the civil rights movement in the 1960s in the United States. I want you to think about what Martin Luther King did. So he delivered this speech many, many times, the famous I Have a Dream speech, and it begins at stage two. It articulates the default future, what's likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along. It also articulates his personal unwillingness to do it, saying essentially, hell no. And when he uttered the words, I have a dream, he was presenting a noble cause. It was his noble cause, his dream, that he was able to articulate so eloquently that really the nation, and even to some extent the world, said no to the default future in unison and said yes to what he was offering as a replacement. And that was his dream. And if you look at the very end of that speech, it ends not just with tribal values, you know, the values of people in the United States, but a line from the speech is, and all of God's children. So he's, of course, invoking his place as a preacher and the values that are universal to human life. So he's making a stage five argument at the end. So what did he do in that speech? Started off at stage two, articulated the default future, made it very clear what's going to happen, showed the inadequacy of that, and then he said no to it. He said hell no to it. And in the moment that really makes people's, you know, just makes them proud is when he really says no to it and then says, but I have a dream today. And it's amazing how 8 and 10-year-old kids know that speech. You know, they don't know the context of it, but they know the speech. That's how you work this as a group, moving people from stage two to stage three to stage four, potentially all the way up to stage five. So want to give you just a couple practices, and then we'll see if there are any burning questions or comments from the group. Here are some practices. Number one, for your individual default future, you want to journal every single day, ideally when you wake up first thing in the morning. And what do you want to journal about? Whatever's on your mind. And over time, you'll begin to see what your default future is, maybe at a much deeper level than you've been able to do on this call. Just journal every day, every day. I'm borrowing pretty liberally here from The Artist's Way book, that idea of just seeing what comes up. And eventually, that will begin to change what you journal about, and you'll begin to see your own desires, your own highest aspirations, your core values come up as a potential substitute for the default future. So just very simply, you just want to journal every day. That becomes very important. And second is you want to find a coach, maybe it's someone here on this call, that can help you identify the deterministic screen, the web of words that you're using when you define, when you start describing your dream. Now, this is where the words link to other words. And so another person is able to hear it much more clearly, much more consistently than you can. And they'll say, well, every time you talk about, you know, your art or your dream, you know, you really bring up connections with other people, and you bring up excellence, and you bring up a sense of a world that's enlightened or something. But it often takes another person to help to tease out your noble cause. They'll often hear it before you will. And then when they say it to you, you'll say, that's it exactly. And what precisely are they doing? They're listening for the web of words that you're using when you're talking about your invented future. And then the practice to use for this in a tribe, in a work tribe, is exactly what we've done on this call. You get people, just ask them the question, you know, what's likely to happen if nothing unexpected comes along as a group? And then what actions do we find ourselves taking? And then is that what we want? And if the answer is no, remember you've got a fundamental choice. You either start over or you say yes to the default future. You know, I hope not. That's not up to the level of rewriting the future. It's got to be kind of a hell no. And then as a group, you want to find that noble cause. You want to find those shared values, those collective core values that can give us the genesis of really a new invented future. And so with that, I just, again, want to thank you for your time and then see if there are any burning comments or questions. So,
yeah, hello. This is Sheward from Houston.
Hi.
The question I have is that my default future is that I'm a disappointment. So I build it up and I do really good and then I sabotage it to fulfill on the default future, that it's a disappointment. And now I'm kind of stuck in creating a new future that I don't trust myself of not sabotaging what I create.
Right. Well, and so a technique from coaching that can really help, and I appreciate the question, is in the management lingo, we call that a derailer, that you find yourself derailing your own success. What's true of a derailer is other people will see you do it before you will. And so you want to form what's called an anchoring relationship with one or two other people. And this is how an anchoring relationship works. So if Julie and I were to set it up, I would say, you know, Julian, I was sharing with some people at the break when you were in breakout rooms, part of my default future, you know, it just is what it is that I was kind of going to be average. That was my default future. It's going to be average. And so at some point I, you know, wasn't making progress on my dissertation and, you know, realized that was really going up against where I thought I was kind of supposed to be. So I formed a relationship with somebody, and it's all the insights that came out of the process that I told you about. When you see me doing the kind of average thing and, you know, opting out and not really going for it, would you tell me? Because they'd see it before I would. And then to really make the anchoring relationship work, it's got to be reciprocal. So there were people, one guy, I won't say what his name was, that I went to grad school with, but a good friend of mine, he said, you know, I'm just kind of, and I'm going to substantially clean up his language here, a jerk, okay? And I don't realize that I'm doing it. I just go into jerk mode, and could you let me know? So there were a number of times we'd sit together in class. You've got to understand these PhD classes are often five people, you know, along with a professor. And, you know, he'd kick me under the table, meaning you're doing the average thing, and I'd kick him under the table, meaning you're doing the jerk thing. And that was just a reminder, oh, yeah, right, I'm doing the thing. So you want to set up those relationships where other people are committed to your noble cause, your invented future, not your default future. That's what it takes. It requires other people in your tribe. Now, just say one more quick thing about it. At CultureSync, we have a belief, okay, it's just a, you know, can't really prove it, but it's a belief, that reinvention does not happen individually. It happens in a tribe. So it requires a tribe of people that you educate about what your noble cause is, and probably at the same time, you're finding the tribal noble cause so that everybody is reinventing themselves together. Now, that's really where it happens. Did that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much.
Sure. We have time for maybe just one more, and I appreciate we're about 5 minutes over time here. So any other burning questions or comments?
And if for anyone dropping off, let's tell them about the date for that call, Dave. Let's make that a three laws call, that July date.
Okay, we're going to do that on July 17th, which is about a month from today. That's a Saturday, and we're going to do it at the same time, 9 a.m. Pacific time.
All right, great. Yeah, and we'll get you a notice to that here in this coming week, but you can lock it into your calendar now just to expect it, and you'll get some follow-up information on how to register for that call. And we can hold up to 500 people on this line, so you can share it with anybody. It'll be similar format to what we've had today. So. We can support quite a few people on that call. So how about let's call on Josh Cohen.
Thanks.
Hello, Josh.
Yes.
Great. Just a quick question on the journaling, Dave, which is a wonderful idea. It seems so simple, but probably powerful. How long would one want to journal in any given day?
Well, the artist way gives the following advice, and then I'll give you what I found effective for me. The artist way says you write for a page or two, and you fill up the page, and you keep writing. And if you're not sure what you want to write, then you write anyway. And you might even write, I don't know what to write, but I'm writing anyway. I don't know what to write. I still don't know what to write. I want coffee. Man, I want coffee. I want coffee really. You just write whatever's kind of on your brain, but you're just getting it down, and it is a free flow of information. What I do is a little different. I write, and some of you have heard my time management stuff, but I write for 20 minutes. I have a little counter on my computer. I set it for 20 minutes, and I type into a fully encrypted file so nobody can read it. It's very important that you know that this is for you and you only, right? And so I write everything that's in there, and when the timer goes off at about 20 minutes, I'm done. But the key is you want that just uncensored stuff. Just want it to, and if it seems useless or pointless, then write about that. I don't know what to say. It's useless and it's pointless, and this is dumb, and I want to do it anymore. Great, just get that down. Tomorrow it'll change, or it won't. But eventually, you'll begin to see a real drift into something much more useful, much more aspirational. We might even use the word brilliant. Happens for every person. Anybody else? And again, if you need to, drop off, thank you. Appreciate you being on the call.
Yeah, how about Peter McRae?
Okay, hi, Peter.
Hi. There are large parts of my future that I'm very excited about. I've started a new career in coaching myself. I've got a great champion who's working for me and working for a fantastic company. But when I look at the default future, what I'm most present to is it feels like it's going to be a long, slow slog to get from where I am to where I want to be financially and otherwise. So it was hard for me to say yes or no in the breakout because I love most a good part of my future. I just would prefer it not to be a long, slow slog. How would you coach me in terms of this work?
Okay, well, to be completely honest, you have a bit of BS going on, which is that it has to take a lot of time. Now, if it's in your default future, then it will take a lot of time, right? I mean, it's
exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so you're if you say yes to that, then yeah, it's going to take a lot of time, and you'll even find a reason why that is why it has to be that way. So, you know, if you just kind of looked at the default future, but again, it's got to be as a package, and said, you know, I want this, but I want it soon. You know, and I'm just going to say, you know, hell no to the years of waiting and struggling and suffering. And, you know, here in Los Angeles where I live, it's amazing how some actors will do that. You know, well, I'm supposed to wait tables for 15 years and then maybe I get a break and maybe I won't. And some of the more successful actors have said, you know what, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to do something else. So you can say no to it. And then if you say no to it, then the question is, you know, what do you want? And you start talking about the new timeline. Then we'd immediately want to get you into the micro-strategy process, which is state a very specific outcome just a few weeks from today, you know, maybe 3 months out at most, 100 days out at most, about what that first step would look like. And then we want to get your assets and your outcomes. We've got a lot of resources that are available on the micro-strategy process on the CultureSync website. And if you don't know what that is, you can email us and we'll point that out. But it really starts with saying hell no to it. Because if you don't say hell no to it, then you're going to build a micro-strategy. But really, you still kind of expect it to take a long time. And it's going to take a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Does that help?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Well, so everybody, again, thanks for hanging on a few extra minutes here. Really appreciate your time on Saturday if you're in the part of the world where it is Saturday. If you're in the United States, happy Father's Day. And if you're not in the United States, have a wonderful weekend, and we really, really appreciate your time on the call this morning.